We are so much more careful than other people out there. How is this possible?
This is what was running through Julia Moore Vogel's mind in July 2020, just a few months into the pandemic.
The only time I left the apartment was to take my two-year-old outside to play in the driveway, basically, of the apartment building. So, you know, I made cloth masks that we wore, but it wasn't enough. And I must have gotten it in the hallway where it was just enclosed.
Vogel is senior program director at Scripps Research and also works with the patient-led research collaborative for long COVID. Her first symptom of the virus was not being able to taste the peppermint tea she has every morning. From there, things got worse. Vogel had shortness of breath that was triggered whether she was sitting up or just resting.
I would go to sleep at night thinking, am I going to die today? And, you know, I made a will, which I had never done. It's hard to remember how scary it was, you know, now because we're so flippant about it.
When Vogel went back to work, she said it felt like her brain was moving slower. It took her longer to do work assignments, and she got tired easily. Vogel knew about long COVID, and she didn't want it.
And so I decided I'm going to be one of those people that recovers. Within 6 months, I'm going to be healthy. And by New Year's Eve, I'm going to be having a glass of champagne, toasting the new year. And I made it my goal to recover. And now it's like, it was so naive of me to think it was within my control.
Vogel says her first year with long COVID was about recovery. As she learned about her limitations, year two was about not getting worse. Still, by year three, it was difficult for her to do everyday tasks like cooking, cleaning, or standing in the shower. And that's when she focused on identifying as disabled.
You know, I got a manual wheelchair, and it was like the most joyful thing for me to be able to go out in public more without having to expend so much energy. The first time I used one was I went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium with my family, and I hadn't done anything like that in forever because I just knew I couldn't walk around. And it was like, wow, this is revolutionary. My husband can push me and I can just sit here and be part of this. You know, it was so joyful for me.
Now in year four, Vogel is focused on advocacy. And for long COVID patients like her, it still feels like they're living in the thick of the pandemic.
I mean, I basically act like it's 2020. I wear an N95 anytime I go in public. I really very much minimize my interactions with other people. Everybody is at risk if you get COVID of getting long COVID. And just because you didn't get it on your first infection or your first three infections doesn't mean you're in the clear. Every infection is a roll of the dice.
And new numbers from the CDC this month show 6.8% of adults in the U.S. have long COVID. Consider this. 4 years since the pandemic hit, patients with long COVID are still fighting for answers. From NPR, I'm Ari Shapiro. It's Thursday, March 14th.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if blocking those proteins and stopping runaway cell division was possible? Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. More at danafarber.org/everywhere. This message comes from NPR sponsor LiveRight, publishers of Left 4 Dead, Shipwreck, Treachery, and Survival at the Edge of the World by Eric J. Dolan. The true story of five castaways abandoned on the Falkland Islands during the War of 1812. Available wherever books are sold.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy. Plus, get access to a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
It's Consider This from NPR. This week marks 4 years since the outbreak of COVID-19 was officially declared a pandemic. And one of the most vexing legacies, one science still has not solved, is long COVID. That's the debilitating condition that can develop in the aftermath of an infection. So where do things stand? NPR health reporter Will Stone covers long COVID. Hi, Will.
Hey, Ari.
I think most people at this point are familiar with what long COVID is, this illness that can plague some people for months or years after an infection. Are new cases of long COVID still a risk today?
They are. I mean, doctors are still seeing new patients showing up at their clinic who've developed long COVID after even just a mild reinfection. Now, exactly, you know, what the risk is, it's hard to say. There is data to suggest the chance of getting long COVID has gone down compared to a few years ago. And one likely factor is there's more immunity built up in the population. Studies have consistently found vaccination does reduce your risk of developing long COVID. You know, how much, though, is up for debate. An ongoing problem here, Ari, is that there are still different definitions of the illness. And in general, the U.S. doesn't have a great surveillance system in place that can accurately capture all the cases.
Well, that being the case, is there any kind of a number? Do we know how many people in the U.S. are struggling with long COVID?
It depends who you ask. I spoke to Dr. Ziad Al-Ali. He's an epidemiologist at Washington University in St. Louis and the VA. He studies long COVID. He estimates there are about 20 million people in the U.S. with long COVID, and that's based on a few different sources. But Al-Ali says, this uncertainty about how many people are affected, it actually underscores a broader point, which is that there's still a lack of consensus in a number of critical areas when it comes to long COVID research. And that's one thing slowing down progress.
Until we sort of solve that piece and come to a consensus of how do we really define long COVID, what are the entry criteria for clinical trials, how do we measure things in clinical trial in a way that would be also acceptable to the FDA, you know, big players like big pharma are unlikely to really invest heavily in this field because of those uncertainties.
And this really is key. If you talk to researchers and patient advocates, they will tell you what's really needed right now are well-designed and well-funded clinical trials that can test different treatments. There are some in the works, but it's not happening at nearly the scale you'd expect for a problem of this magnitude.
And so is it the case that there is not much in the way of treatment for patients?
No, I mean, there are no FDA-approved treatments for the condition. In fact, there isn't really a widely accepted test or method that doctors can use to diagnose it. There are specialized clinics for long COVID. Doctors tend to focus on treating individual symptoms. And some patients do have success, others not so much. I mean, that's assuming you can get seen there in the first place. I'd say a big source of frustration right now is the federal government's involvement. Several years ago, the National Institutes of Health launched an effort called RECOVER, and despite $1 billion being set aside, it has not delivered any groundbreaking results yet. Scientists who are working on long COVID, they tell me they're worried there just isn't an adequate vision and an ongoing source of money to move this work forward.
Okay, so Will, what I hear you saying is there's no widely accepted definition of what long COVID is. We don't have an accurate number of how many people have it. We don't know how to treat it. I mean, is there anything that science has definitively learned about it? It does seem like every week there are new studies about what might be going on.
Absolutely, Ari. I mean, there is no doubt scientists have actually made real strides in understanding the illness. We know it can affect many organ systems. The symptoms someone develops and how long they last, that tends to vary. So, for example, some people will predominantly have fatigue and cognitive problems. Others, you know, it'll be mostly cardiovascular issues. And there are now a handful of pretty well-developed theories about what could be driving the illness.
What are those theories?
So just to tick off a few, there's a lot of attention on the idea of viral persistence, that essentially remnants of the virus, maybe genetic material or a protein, we're not sure, can stick around in your body, and that could spark all kinds of other problems. There are clear signs of immune dysfunction, possibly an autoimmune response. There's also intense interest in the role of the gut microbiome, inflammation in the vascular system. And more recently, we've heard a lot about problems with the mitochondria, and these help power cells.
But Will, that's so many different theories. It sounds like if somebody wants to know what's actually going on in their body, science still can't definitively tell them?
Yeah, I mean, the tricky thing here is scientists are finding these biological abnormalities. They just don't know what's at the root of the illness. And to make things even more complicated, Ari, it's possible multiple things are happening in some patients, but not others. It seems pretty clear long COVID is not just one kind of illness.
And you mentioned this frustration about funding. As we get farther away from the pandemic, is there an expectation that this research will continue with the same urgency and momentum that it's had?
I think it will. I mean, there are valid concerns about funding and lack of interest by drug companies, but I've been struck at how scientists from many different fields have come together to work on this. I've reported on the unprecedented amount of collaboration we're seeing between top research groups and with the community of patients who are, in many cases, helping drive this research. Here's how Ziad Al-Ali sums up the situation.
In the span of less than 4 years, we've made all that progress. But I'm also very cognizant that for the people who are hurting, for the people who are suffering from long COVID, that understanding is good, but it's really not good enough.
So there is tension here. On the one hand, scientists have learned a lot. At the same time, there's frustration that we're not farther along. And for some people, this has meant literally years living with a chronic illness, in some cases unable to work or go to school, while they wait for more answers.
That was NPR health reporter Will Stone.
The reporting you heard at the top of this episode was from Brianna Scott, who also produced today's episode. It was edited by Scott Hensley and Courtney Dorning. Our executive producer is Sammy Yenigan. It's Consider This from NPR. I'm Ari Shapiro.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Humana. Your employees are more than your coworkers. They're the heartbeat of your business. That's why Humana offers modern group benefits designed to protect employees and their families with dental, vision, life, and disability coverage. Humana knows every employee and every business is unique. That's why they listen to your needs and build plans with you and your team in mind. That's the power of human care.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.